Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Anything less than 80 degrees, but I would still say we're kind of hitting those really, like today, the last couple days, kind of been in the 50s and 60s. This is more of a situation of it's not that the temperatures are too cool for the plant, but we're actually introducing more issues with soil-borne diseases because they like the cool, wet conditions.
Kansas State agronomist Tina Sullivan.
The one that mainly comes to mind would be Phytophthora fruit rot, as mentioned in our latest e-update for soybeans and saturated soil conditions. If you think you have a soybean seedling disease or an issue, always feel free to reach out to, you know, your local K-State extension office or get in touch with plant pathology in the diagnostics lab.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The Ag Economy Barometer Index rose 10 points to a reading of 158. That's the highest barometer reading we've received since May of 2021.
Dr. Jim Mintert is Professor Emeritus, Purdue University, on the CME Group Ag Economy Barometer.
The current condition index rose 5 points to a reading of 146. Once again, that's the highest current condition index since December of 2021. While the future expectation index rose 12 points to 164, which was the highest future expectation index readings since April of 2021. The farm financial performance index rose 8 points to 109. That's just 2 points lower than it was back in January. The farm capital investment index fell 6 points this month, but that was still strong relative to the last 3 years. We have to go back to 2021 to find a May reading that was higher than this year's reading. The short-term farmland value expectation index at 124 jumped 14 points above the prior month, and that was the highest reading for the index since March of 2024. We've been asking producers their expectations for ag exports going back to 2019, and this month the percentage of producers who said they expect exports to increase over the next 5 years skyrocketed to 52%. That's up from just 33% who felt that way a month earlier. This was the highest percentage who said they expect to see ag exports grow over the next 5 years since November of 2020. We asked producers for the third month in a row what impact they expect the U.S. government's imposition of tariffs on imports will have on their farm's income in 2025. And compared to March and April, fewer producers in May said they expect a negative impact on farm income from the U.S.'s use of tariffs. This month, that was 43% who expected either a very negative or a negative impact. That compares to 56% who felt that way back in April. We asked producers this month how important it is to them that a new farm bill be passed in 2025. And for the second month in a row, over half of the producers in the survey this month, it was 51%, said they think that passage of a new farm bill is either important or very important. We did a follow-up with them and said, what do you expect to see happen with respect to the PLC reference prices for both corn and soybeans? Do you expect to see those prices to be unchanged, increased, or reduced? And in both cases, roughly 4 out of 10 producers expect to see PLC reference prices for corn and soybeans to increase in the new farm bill. Finally, our last question, which we've asked now a couple of times, is do you expect the increased use of tariffs by the U.S. to strengthen or weaken the U.S. ag economy in the long run? And for 2 months in a row, roughly 70% of the producers have said they expect to see the use of tariffs to strengthen the U.S. ag economy in the long run. In April, it was 70%. This month, it was 69%, so virtually no change.
So why did the barometer go higher? Mintert with the director of the Center for Commercial Ag, Michael Langemeyer.
So the biggest reason the barometer went up was because people became more optimistic about the future, but they also became a little more optimistic about the current situation on their farms and in the U.S. ag economy. I wasn't surprised that the barometer went up, but maybe the magnitude of the jump was a little bit surprising.
Yeah, I'm in the same camp. I wasn't surprised it went up. During the week we were asking this, there was some good news regarding tariffs with respect to China. I don't exactly what the timing was there, but it certainly was during that week. And so I think that played into the optimism we saw in this month's reading. I'm still surprised, however, that the index of current conditions is as strong as it is. That also went up 5 points. So that was a little surprising to me.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The cash markets have had a positive tone. Let me put a bow on that for a moment.
Kansas State livestock economist, Dr. Glenn Tonser.
When we go to wholesale beef, box beef cutout on Friday was $3.66, up about $4 from the week before. And then select was $3.56, up almost $5. So that choice select spread, sometimes we see it widen further here during grilling season. That's worth watching. But the fact that we saw additional gains in the box beef sector is of note.
Moving ahead, what are his price expectations?
I would expect choppy waters for the next several months. The near-term supply situation is supportive, but I think we're going to have a lot of variation on the demand side that might pause some of that supply-driven, you know, strength. So elevated volatility would actually be my best prediction, rather than ongoing kind of nonstop gains, which we've had sort of for the most part since the beginning of the year, at least in the cattle complex. One more thing to note is the sustainable beef plant that operates now in North Platte, Nebraska, came online here. You know, we're wrapping this up very early in June is when you and I are talking, but the very end of May, that plant came online. And I'm interjecting it because it is, you know, directly relevant to some of our listeners that operate in this region. And more generally, there's been lots of comments the last several years about possibly adding additional beef cattle processing to the industry. You know, the quotes that are out there is once it's fully operational, this North Platte operation might handle 1,500 head a day. So that's a pretty good sized plant. There are larger plants operating in both Nebraska and Kansas, but this is not a smaller one that might only do 20 head a day is the point. So it is worth watching. I mean, it's a market relevant one. But it's also worth remembering, you know, ground was broke nearly 3 years ago, October of 2022, and many years of planning before that. I'm only giving us that reminder because it's easy to overlook all the work and the time and the buildup to these. And even though the plant is now online, it's not fully, you know, they're not harvesting 1,500 head yet. They'll work up to that. So these are truly multi-year decisions and then multi-year buildups and then multiple month ramp-ups once we start these plants.
So that's price expectations. What about feedlot returns?
So there's a very positive story there for those that are unhedged. So consistent with the fed cattle market's been going up, so you've been rewarded for that if you're unhedged, at least on the output part of this. So as a quick reminder, on our Ag Manager website, listeners can find every month we put up this barometer of feedlot returns, and it's a cash. So unhedged sales, unhedged purchases of both feeder cattle and corn. That's really important to keep in mind because if my bad Nostradamus comment about more volatility is correct, that hedge or not hedge, you know, decision is very relevant. But regardless, the barometer that I just published this past week would suggest the returns from here in May through October for steers will be north of $200. So just as an example, a steer leaving in June, so leaving a Kansas yard at market ready weights, is projected to have a positive return of $352. And that stays very positive north of $200 all the way out through October. What's underneath that pretty positive historical margin is some moderating cost of gain, notably improved fed cattle prices. And then we did not yet see the escalation in feeder cattle prices 6-7 months earlier with those. The part that changes by the time we get out to the end of 2025, so fast forward out to, say, Thanksgiving, November of 25, those projected returns actually turn negative. And it's not because the fed cattle market, I mean, there is a little bit of decline being forecasted, but the biggest change is we're now paying $30 to $35 a hundredweight more for the cattle coming in. So consistent with a much higher feeder cattle market, that sort of catches up in this exercise. And that's just the reminder, right, of this ongoing risk and offset that feedlot managers have to work through. But for the summer and, you know, certainly through Labor Day, it looks like a very positive margin environment for those that were fully exposed to the market.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Moody's says in 9 budget years, 30% of our tax collections is interest.
Chairman of the Joint Economic Council is David Schweikert from Arizona, alongside Texas Representative Chip Roy.
We have a model that shows a 1% increase rolled into our refinancing in 10 years, 45% of all U.S. tax collections. All of it is interest. You have members here running around saying, I need more money for SALT. I want actually more money for this program. I want more money for this. Okay. Bring us ideas of how we modernize spending, how we can reduce costs by technology, by better systems, by a healthier society. But stop showing up at my door demanding more spending.
The question I have for the gentleman, when I first When I graduated from law school at the University of Texas in 2003, the national debt was somewhere in the $6 trillion range, $6.5 trillion. Mm-hmm. When I came to Congress, when I was campaigning to come to Congress, it was just over $20 trillion. That was 2018. Today, we are pushing $37 trillion. Is that roughly correct?
Yeah, if you add in internally financed.
Correct.
The CBO says we will end this year at about 37.2. My number is 37.3.
So now I bring that up because nobody at home understands that. You're doing a good job trying to put it in context.
12 zeros.
Trying to explain it about the amount of money we're borrowing per family or taxpayer or per second. But to put it in stark terms, what we're talking about with the debt and the deficits, what it really means is the inability to afford a house for the average American, right? Because the impact that flows from it is, as you alluded to, higher interest rates, a inability for the Fed and for Congress to continue to borrow and print money because of what you're describing worldwide, the ability to have people to buy our debt goes down. The cost of debt is going to go up. The interests are going up. Inflation is going up. And the average American family is going to take it on the chin. That's what we're talking about. And the reason I bring that up is because our colleagues, as you point out, run around here saying, I need more money for the program. I need more money for fill in the blank. I need more money for Medicaid. I need more money for SALT. Why? Because they feel like they've got a political interest in doing so. I'm sure the gentleman had, like I did yesterday, the Farm Bureau coming into your office and needing help. Guess what? I understand why they need help, because we, the federal government, have messed up their lives quite vociferously.
We distort.
And we distort, and so they want help. I get it. But then what do? Vote for food stamps? I'm a cancer survivor. You know that. And I have cancer groups coming in asking for money. I look at them and I say, well, can you go find some way to pay for it? And a lot of my colleagues don't want to do that. And I'll close with this. President Reagan had a great quote on the Johnny Carson show, late night show in the 70s, before he was president, in which he said, every program that a politician brings forward should have to come with a tax increase attached to it. Why is that? Was President Reagan pro-tax increases? I know the gentleman from Arizona knows that not to be true. President Reagan believed in tax cuts and more money in the pockets of Americans to create wealth, to create economic growth. But why he said that was because we promise things we can't deliver. We promise things that we deliver that are fake, because we're doling out money, printing money to pay for programs. And then on the other side of the ledger, we never want to say we need a tax increase to pay for it, because we rightly understand tax increases constrain the economy. In other words, in short, we put ourselves in the box we've created.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The U.S. beef industry faces a critical turning point as cattle herds hit their lowest levels in over 70 years. It's driving record-high beef prices amid strong consumer demand. Now, prolonged droughts, high input costs, elevated interest rates have fueled herd liquidation. Industry experts predict herd rebuilding may not begin until late 2025 or 26, and significant growth could be delayed until 2027 due to the slow production cycle. Now, the cycle does mirror the 2011 through 2014 period, when drought slashed inventories, pushing prices to historic highs before the rebuilding began in 2015. Today's market, however, faces unique pressures from global imports and consumer demand for sustainable beef. Producers investing in heifer retention and efficient practices could thrive, though, as the cycle shifts. Consumers may see beef prices climb towards $10 a pound, potentially shifting demand to cheaper cuts or even alternative proteins. U.S. biofuels industry in limbo as the 45Z Clean Fuel Production Tax Credit, designed to boost low-carbon fuel production, faces ongoing uncertainty. Biden administration issued partial guidance back in January, but critical details on carbon intensity calculations and climate smart ag practices remain unclear. It leaves producers unable to utilize the credit fully. Now, the Trump administration's 90-day halt on 45Z, announced in January, did spark fears of production shutdowns, with 25 to 75% of the industry at risk of idling without swift action. Of course, biofuel groups urging Congress to extend the credit through 2034 and limit it to domestic feedstock. They're also pressing the Treasury for finalized rules to restore market stability. India and the U.S. set to hold high-stakes trade talks in Washington, D.C., aiming to finalize an interim trade deal by late June to avert looming U.S. tariffs. India seeking to protect $66 billion in exports, offering to slash tariffs, though, on U.S. ag products like almonds, cranberries, bourbon whiskey. And they're looking at slashing these tariffs from 30 to 100% to as little as 5%, while safeguarding their dairy and food grain sectors in an attempt to shield local farmers. U.S., though, is pushing for greater market access for its farm goods, and that includes apples, tree nuts, genetically modified crops, trying to tap into India's vast market and reduce a $45 billion trade deficit. Now, a deal could boost U.S. ag exports, already worth $2 billion in India, by opening new opportunities for farmers in states, especially like California, but across the Midwest. Now, both sides are aiming to double their bilateral trade to $500 billion by 2030, but India's reluctance to lower dairy tariffs and U.S. reciprocal tariff threats remain hurdles. This is Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Determining feed or forage intake in a beef cow is simple.
So how much does a cow eat? Dave Lallman is an Oklahoma State beef cattle specialist.
As it turns out, it's quite difficult. And we are uniquely situated and equipped to do that kind of research here at Oklahoma State University. Many years ago, the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine published an equation to estimate feed or forage intake in a beef cow. And so that work was done 30-plus years ago, or at least the data used in the equation was published a long time ago. So it turns out that estimating feed intake in beef cows is one of our specialties here at the Range Cow Research Center. And so we just recently published a paper where we have taken many different experiments that we've conducted here and others have conducted other places around the country and pulled those together and tried to determine if the old equation the National Academy of Sciences is using is accurately estimating feed intake in beef cows. What we've learned is that it does a pretty good job. The old equation does a pretty good job when the quality of feed or forage is very low. But as quality, you know, average quality or high quality forage or high quality mixed diet, that old equation was really underestimating feed intake in modern beef cows. What is the difference and why does it matter? Well, I think, you know, the primary usefulness of an accurate estimate of feed intake is to use it to estimate nutrient requirements of a beef cow, say for winter supplementation, making sure they have adequate protein and energy. The other use of an equation like that is for some of the breed associations to use their multi-trait selection indexes. So what is the cost of a cow? What's the cost of a 1,500-pound cow versus a 1,000-pound cow? Well, in order to estimate the difference in cost, you have to have an accurate estimate of feed intake. So what we discovered is that the old equation is basically predicting that on average, an average quality forage, a cow would consume somewhere in the neighborhood of about 26 pounds per day, 26.3 to be exact. And the new equation we developed from this work indicates that those cows are actually consuming, on average, about 31 pounds of feed or forage per day. Well, forage and average quality forage per day. So that's about a 15% increase in forage intake in modern beef cows compared to what that old National Academy of Sciences Engineering Medicine equation estimated. Having an accurate estimate of feed intake in a modern beef cow is important because, you know, you have to know what an animal is going to consume before you can determine if they're receiving adequate amount of protein and energy. So there's a summary of the recent publication that involves a lot of the work we've done over the last few years. But let me tell you, that's just the tip of the iceberg on details related to things that influence intake in a beef cow. And so if you'd like to dig into that a little bit more, just go to the sunup.okstate.edu.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
There's an article on the Manhattan Institute written by, I believe, Jessica Riedel. It's now about a year and a half old.
Representative David Schweikert of Arizona is chairman of the Joint Economics Council, says departments within government don't talk to each other.
But what they did is they went through basically all the proposals the left has on raising taxes. And step by step, did the, here's the tax raise, here's the economic effects, here's what you actually take in. Remember our rules about size of the economy, 17.1, or mid 17% of the GDP. Individual income tax, investment tax, raising the corporate taxes, raising the state taxes. When you got to the end, you functionally were getting about 1.5% of new tax receipts for the economy. Okay, I look forward to the Democrats, you know, actually proposing this and actually being willing to vote on it, because they throw these things out, they get them scored, they controlled everything here a couple years ago. You notice they never did them? But pretending this solves the problem, so you get 1.5%, you will have stagnated the economy. You already hear the discussions of how close are you to stagflation, which is partially driven because of the economics. And remember, at the end of the decade, or with 9 years or so, 22, 23% of the population is 65 and up. We have a demographic issue for productivity. The point of showing this chart is the solutions you will hear if, God forbid, you go on left-wing cable television, sometimes even right-wing. They're mathematical lies. We're borrowing 7.3% of the economy this year. Are we willing to engage in a revolution of using technology, modernization? How many businesses still run themselves as if it's still the 1990s? Government does. I had someone bring me just the other day a healthcare paperwork. I think it might have been from the Indian Health Services. It was three-part NCR paper for a purchase order for a healthcare procedure that you fill out, and I think you faxed it in. Have we lost our minds yet? You get protesters from the left saying, don't use technology. You've seen the article after article of the five major databases the United States have. None of them talk to each other. If you're willing to actually read, you saw the stories of Small Business Administration having, 3,300 people that had taken out loans, except the small problem is all of them were 114 years and up, meaning they were onto their rewards. They weren't with us anymore. Turns out those $300 million in loans, no one had paid a dime back, but the Small Business Administration didn't have the ability to bounce off the Social Security mortality or death file. We've designed these walls to functionally, it's as if the fraudsters designed our data systems here in the federal government. Let's go fill out things, let's go get money, let's steal the taxpayers' money, but we're going to make sure that there's no way to check the data that's being filled out, because we want to protect the privacy. Some of that's not privacy. You're asking for a government-insured loan over here, and you can't check the death file? What idiots allow this to happen? And yet you get protesters in front of your congressional offices saying, don't let Doge and those actually make the system work. I'm sorry you're scared of change. Did I mention to you we borrow $72,000 a second? How do you convince our brothers and sisters across the country, we as members of Congress, the administration, the bureaucracy are taking it seriously if you're not even willing to make the data talk to each other.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Parts of the country's soybean crop are nearing planting completion. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey with the progress as of June 1st.
We have three Western Corn Belt states, Iowa, Nebraska, and Minnesota, where the planting progress on soybeans has reached or exceeded 95%. But like corn, we do have some slower numbers in the Eastern Corn Belt. Ohio soybeans, 66% planted on June 1st. Five-year average there, 77%.
The look at bean crop emergence shows
63% of the U.S. soybeans emerged by June 1st, ahead of the five-year average of 57% and last year's 53%.
And as for the first look of U.S. soybean crop condition,
67% of the crop rated good to excellent, just 5% very poor to poor, and only a handful of states into the double digits for very poor to poor ratings.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.